I'm recording Fred Finn today, and I'd like to have him talk about his time in the service and then also his career. So, Fred, how did you get into the service?
Okay, well, we left also, I was at the University of Arizona, and my freshman and sophomore year when the war was declared December 7, 1941, of course. And the Navy, I was up for the draft, but I knew I would be going into the service. And about that time, the Navy advertised that if you're interested in joining the V-12 program, there would be some future for you as get to continue your education. So as I said last time, I was getting an honorable discharge from the ROTC. We were horse-mounted cavalry. I got an honorable discharge from the Army, so I could be enlisted in the Navy V-12 program, take some examinations, and was accepted. And I got some orders pretty fast to go to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where the University of Mexico was, which had a Navy ROTC unit there. So I reported there in July of 1943, June or July of 1943, and I had to set up a program that I would get a degree in 4 semesters. So the head of the civil engineering department there said, "This is no problem. We can get you lined up to do that." And it was really kind of a lark in a way, many ways, because my board and room was provided. I had no outside interest particularly at the time. So I was telling Ruth here just a while ago that my grades were better in those years because I had no distractions. And we were we would get leave on weekends, Saturday night, but every other night you had to be in your bed, in your bunk, and doing your studies. So anyway, I finished there and got my bachelor's degree in civil engineering. Now, I did not know really just what branch of the Navy I'd be going in, but I knew it was going to be in engineering because of the civil engineering part. And I was aware of the Seabees from John Wayne's movie that they'd pick about that time. And so as soon as I got my degree, they were sending us then to Davisville, Rhode Island for possible officer candidate school. So off we went via a cattle car almost to New York, and then from New York to Davisville, Rhode Island, which was the East Coast main training facility for construction battalions, which the Seabees are, the U.S. Naval Construction Battalions. So we spent about 2 months there in officer candidate school, and they taught us a lot of things about naval regulations and discipline and things like that. And they taught us how to navigate at sea, semaphore and code language, and every guy in the Navy's got to know that kind of stuff. So we got that and finished that, and then I got the commission and spent just a short period of time as a commanding officer or an officer, an ensign, and we intertwined with some of the older officers who had been in the service for a while, and we were all bunked up in a different place. But they were very casual compared to what it was at the officer candidate school. But from there, I received then orders to go to San Francisco for a further assignment. And I wasn't in San Francisco more than about a week, and they sent me then to San Diego, where they put me with a lot of other guys. Now, we're traveling now with guys that we all know were going to be assigned to the Civil Engineering Corps, which is part of the CBs were within the Civil Engineering Corps. And so we went to got on board a mini aircraft carrier in San Diego. There were no aircrafts on it at all. and there were no pilots. It was just transporting supplies, and so we were quartered in that, and it took us about a week or a little less than that to get to Oahu in Hawaii, on Honolulu, actually. And we were then assigned to a barracks there. People said, you stay here and we'll get you orders. And so about a week there, just kind of moseying around town, I was assigned then to the 125th Naval Construction Battalion, which at that time, when I arrived at the battalion headquarters, I was informed that we were deploying. We don't know where we're going, but we knew it was going to be in the Pacific. So the battalion was, one day, was getting a lot of its equipment ready to be transported, which meant bringing everything up to speed and everything. And we were doing a lot of drilling, packs, we were packs in your carbines and marching for miles and stop and turn around and march back and getting a little physical education out of the thing. But before we could be deployed, we were usually attached to Marine or units. And so we were required to go to combat training with the Marines for about 2 weeks, a little over 2 weeks. And that was quite an experience because the Marines, you know, they do it their way. And the CBs were relatively casual, militarily speaking, compared to the Marines. So we were given a variety of things to how you go into a village and recognize a. It was pretty easy. You could see either a Japanese guy or an American guy, and you had to shoot at the back of the Japanese guy or not at the other. So it was a test of your reaction and what have you. But we were carrying regular carbines. We were also taught how to handle a submachine gun. And while we were there, we were also out. We had to learn how to handle a 20-millimeter aircraft, anti-aircraft gun, to aim it and strip it down and clean it up and all that kind of stuff. And because we were going to be equipped with two of those things to protect us. But okay, so now I'm in the battalion, we're being deployed, and eventually after we get finished with the Marines, they had a special training place on the island for this purpose. We were given a compass and a flashlight and a map. We were supposed to do some scouting out to find some locations where the machine guns were being fired just to make noise, I think, more than anything else. So we finished that, and then we embarked out of Honolulu Naval Station. We headed for Okinawa. By this time, we know we're going to Okinawa, but we're also no correspondence at all could say anything. So couldn't tell anybody where we were going, obviously. But we had to stop at a little atoll called Mog Mog, and we had to wait there for a task force to come by it so we could go together with another unit, the units. We sat there for almost 24 days, I think, something like that, just waiting. And every once in a while, the Japanese would fly over and take pictures of us, I guess. And no bombs or anything. They would just kind of reconnoiter. They were aware we were doing something. But then eventually we got orders to move into Okinawa. And we came into the Nagasaki harbor is where we went. And we had to go through the whole drill. You had to get on the little landing craft boats and your backpacks and your weapon, and then they circle around with these little landing crafts, and then finally they get the order to go on into the beach. They didn't quite make it. Of course, the fighting at that time had been moved to the south part of Okinawa, and we were not in a heavy fighting area. It was just to the south of us. But unfortunately, I think I may have mentioned this to you earlier, but we had four landing ships, transports, carrying all of our heavy equipment. And one of the kamikazes got one of those ships while they were landing. And we lost some men on that one. But the rest of us landed up another part of the beach in a little different area. And our first job was to start improving the roads. Now, the CBs are basically a support. We're not a combat train, really trained for combat. This other business with the Marines was just, I don't know, just superficial in many ways. But we had to go through that process, and just in case, I guess. So we made our landing, and then the battalion, my particular company, I was assigned to Company B, and our company was primarily doing the roads, fixing up the roads so that the transfer, they could move supplies and what have you down to where the real action was. But the company then, the main thing was they had the Marston Manning, they had to build a Marston Manning Airport for the Corsairs, the Marine Corsairs, coming in. They had 30 days to get this done because they were expecting these guys to come in and get support. There's still some fighting going on the other part of the island. So they got that done, and then they assigned us then to move to Nagasaki Harbor, where the Japanese had started a big airport there but hadn't finished it. So we were given the job. We were three battalions, actually three battalions, I'm sorry, were combined into one brigade, and we had a commodore as the commander of the brigade. And so when my tent mate at that time was a fellow by the name of Tom Lepps. He was a lieutenant JG. I'm still an ensign. I'm going to be an ensign for a long time. So anyway, Tom was assigned as the engineering officer for the brigade, and he had the job of designing all the facilities for this airport that we were upgrading it, including the airport was pretty much right on the bay. So there was a lot of problems. He had designed some tide gates so that the tide would come in, the gates would be closed, and the tide would go out, the gates would open so that the water could go back out. And so he designed that, and he got quite a commendation for that sort of thing. Anyway, I'm trying to think now that then our biggest problem, we had to bring in coral. Some of it was dredged right out of the harbor, and some of it was brought in from quarries up in the hills. So a lot of hills in Okinawa at that time. There still are, I'm sure. We had a little problem with snipers on the trucks because they would still up in the hills. These guys, a lot of these guys didn't know the war was practically over, and they were just in caves, and the Marines would come through and try to throw hand grenades in these caves and try to get the guys out of it. And eventually the Marines were transferred to the other end of the island and it turned over the finishing job to the Army, so that we were then, but the Marines were still around us all the time. But anyway, so then one of the things that was kind of interesting to us, one day we had B-24s were flying, and we actually were able to get some of the runways going so that they could do some short bombing into Japan on the southern part of Japan. Not much of it, but anyway, the Japanese flew in one day, an assignment, a group of officers, and they landed in the Japanese, we knew they were coming, they landed on the Japanese marked planes, and they were transferred to U.S. planes, and then they went off someplace for a critique with peace. When they start, say they're going to have a stop shooting at each other, so to speak, not an armistice, but just stop for a while so they can do the negotiations. And they were gone for several days, and then they came back in our U.S. planes, and they transferred to the Japanese planes. But we were told that it didn't work. They couldn't come to any ceasefire. That's what I was looking for, any ceasefire. So off they went, and they're back to fighting again. And we could hear them down in this other part of the island, but as I say, it didn't bother us particularly. Our only responsibility was for our perimeter, just to keep snipers and things like that sort of out of the perimeter. But then we get this word over the radio that the U.S. had put on a big new type of a bomb in Japan. And we didn't know anything about atomic bombs or anything like that. But we do, and then immediately after that, of course, we got word that the ceasefire and that the armistice was being signed. And when we got that word, the ships in the harbor just went crazy. They just started shooting up in the air, which they do all the time. Every night the kamikazes were coming in, and they were going after the ships in the harbor. And so they would just, they didn't try to shoot at any particular plane. They just shoot up in the air and hope the Japanese would fly through this, this fill the air with anti-aircraft, mostly 40 millimeter, bigger stuff than 20s. And they shoot down some of them. You could see that it's successful on them sometimes at night. But they did, they hit a ammunition depot not too far away from our camp was, and that ammunition depot went on for a week at a time, just exploding.
Really?
And just kept exploding all. Yeah. It was kind of a sight, but it was the Japanese then used that as for the kamikazes. This is your point, then you go a certain direction from that. They used it as a navigating aid, what we were told anyway. But anyway, now the war's over, and all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but the war's over, and we've got guys have certain number of points that they're going to go home. And so we had huge replacements. The guys with points went home, and they brought in a bunch of young guys and everything, so we had sort of incorporate those with our guys that didn't have points, who were very bitter, because these guys had been overseas by a year and a half at this time, because they've been in Hawaii about a year before I joined them, something like that. So they were pretty bitter about that.
Now, why didn't they have points?
They weren't married. They didn't have families. That's where you got your points. You got points for being overseas, you almost had to be married and have a family at that time to have enough points to be. Because they didn't want to just strip us completely. Probably 30%. I don't know what the percentage was, but a high percentage of the older guys were left. And but my job at that time was presumably to supervise the construction of a huge septic tank. We're now building a camp for about 5,000 people, because they plan to keep this airport going. They were going to occupy Okinawa, of course, and they were going to keep this airport operational as a training place or military base, I guess. They didn't consult me on that particularly. But anyway, I had it was almost underwater at times. I mean, the water level, because we're right out on the bay. So we had to get pumps in and pump that thing out, because once we fill this up, this huge three-cell septic tank, the doggone thing's going to float if you're underwater. So they had to dry it up as best they could and keep it pumping all the time. But I had a chief petty officer, and he was pretty bitter because he did not have a family, and he didn't get to go back. And so he was pretty mad because he'd been already over for about a year and a half. But he knew his job, and my job to him was, and I talked to him, I hadn't a clue of the construction that he was doing. I might be on the design of things, but I didn't know how to build anything at this particular time. And I just marveled at how these guys just pitched in and knew exactly what had to be done. But my job for him was supply. You tell me what you need, and I'll see if I can get it. And one of the things we needed was a crane. And we had some guys that were called anyway, their job was to go around and find things, and they came back with a crane. Don't tell me how they got it. They got this crane, and about a week later, somebody came back and said, "That's our crane." Well, we don't know anything about it. Just showed up, so they took the crane away from us. But by that time, we pretty much had things under control.
Well, good.
But then we started. In addition to that, we pretty well got that done, and then the next thing is build Quonset huts for this 5,000 people. So we started building Quonsonauts. But the guys didn't have much enthusiasm. The war's over, mm-hmm. and they're just waiting for their orders to go home. So the production was pretty bad. And then we got word from the battalion, or from the brigade, that when we get this airport finished, you're going home. And the production speeded up almost immediately. So then we got the orders to go home. And I was on a transport, assigned to a transport to bring guys back to San Francisco. And of course, by this time, now we stayed about 6 months beyond the armistice. Because, again, we had this job to do, and they wanted it done before we left. And we were only working, of course, when the war was on, it was 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. But when the war was over, well, we were working about 6 days a week. And on Sundays, we would go out to the beach, and it had beautiful beaches because Okinawa was a resort area for the Japanese. And so the beautiful beaches, and so we'd go to the beach once in a while and at that time. But anyway, you go home and come through the San Francisco Bay into San Francisco, and it's the tides coming in to the San Francisco are very strong, and the waves are big as you go in. Incidentally, I get sick every time they bring the anchors up. I get sick. It would take about 2 days, and then I'm fine. Uh-huh. After that, I could eat anything. But coming into San Francisco, I was pretty sick the first day or two. But there were no parades, no nothing when we came in. Uh-huh. People just sort of accepted you as we were going home. And I was discharged then and went back to my hometown of Yuma, Arizona. And started. And I received a letter then from my friend, Lieutenant Leps. He'd come back early. He'd been discharged, transferred, and went to work for the Southern California Edison in L.A. His office was in L.A. But the Edison was building a new dam in the back in the High Sierras. I think I mentioned this to you the other day, building this dam in the High Sierras. And I got a letter from him and offering me a job. And I think I've told you this too, probably.
But still,
yeah, but I said, I'm, you know, I'm kind of tired of this. I'd like to take some time off. Depression. We're not too far off away from. My mother remembered the Depression, of course, 30s, to mid 30s, and she said, "No, you need to take that job," and so I did. It was the best decision I ever made. It led me to meet my wife up in the Sierras, and we eventually. She was going to the University of California, and between her junior and senior year. And I was already, this Tom Leps again had arranged for me to have some interviews to go back to school to get a master's degree and a teaching assistantship. So I went interviewed for that and I got those appointments. So, but I remembered her, I've told this story.
Sure. No, I want to hear it again.
Yeah, well, she didn't interest me. I didn't make a good impression on her that first night. I asked her for a dance they were having at the lodge, and so we'd had a dance, and you know, I got the gum in her hair and all that kind of stuff. And so I was telling her about going back to the university. I think she thought I was giving her a snow job of some kind. But anyway, I did go back, and at that time in the administration building, all students had their cards and a card, and anybody could go in and if they know the name, and I remembered her name because I fell into love with her the first time I saw her.
This is wonderful.
Well, anyway, I got her name and a phone number, and so I started calling her. Well, she's going with somebody else at this time. But about every other week or so, I'd call and check in on her. One day she said, well, we kind of broke up or something. So I asked her for a Coke date at Edie's and a little place in Berkeley. And so we started dating. And obviously, eventually, mm-hmm. we got married August the 6th, 1949. Is that right?
Very good. You got some points there.
Yeah. Well, I thank you. She didn't want to get married. She'd promised herself or her folks that she wouldn't get married until after she had her degree. And to the blessings of her mother kind of said, "What are you guys waiting for?" So that pulled the rug out from under. So we got married between her junior and senior year.
Great.
And her grades went up immediately.
Oh, you were and such a good influence.
Yeah, well, because we were dating, we were going out an awful lot, and the evenings and kind of interfering with our studies. We had this apartment in Berkeley, and another one of my tent mates said we'd rented this apartment in anticipation of our getting married. But the lady didn't like to rent to couples because they demanded so much. So Ruth had to go be interviewed by this this manager. They got off well and became good friends, so it worked out quite well. So now I'm pretty well on my way to my master's degree. And in fact, I guess I've finished it this first year back. I got my master's the same day that she got her bachelor's.
Wow. Uh-huh.
And my mother came out from Yuma while I was getting my degree, and I didn't go through the process. So she was pretty upset with me, but Ruth did. So anyway, then shortly thereafter, I was in the Navy Reserve. They didn't give me a discharge at this time. I actually did get an honorable discharge. I'm sorry, I did. But I was still in the active reserve. And I got a letter from a friend of mine who had been a professor at the university. And he get this letter, says, "So you're going to be, your number's coming up. And you'll be called up here, but there's a billet for you if you want it in San Diego in the District Public Works office. We got that letter, and that night I took that letter to the post office, the answer to it, said, "You know, sign me up." So we got orders. She was teaching school for the first time. She taught.
First job, yes.
First job as a teacher in what, third or fourth grade or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And they were mostly Japanese, a lot of Japanese students. And she was also at the Wesley Foundation at the Methodist Church there, a group of mostly Japanese, were they all Japanese, weren't they, Ruth?
Was at the Y.
At the, oh, I'm sorry.
The YMCA.
Oh, YMCA, I'm sorry.
Who sponsored these kids coming back from the detention camp where they had, and anyway, the teenagers needed a leader, so I took them on, and it was just delightful.
They were just, I used to have to chaperone with her when they would have.
We'd have a party.
Parties, yeah. They were just so wonderful. I mean, they were really a delight.
Even after they've been in the detention.
Yeah.
They're very family-oriented, and of course that just made them stronger.
Sure.
And their whole life with their family. So when an awful lot of Japanese people live in the Bay Area, on the East Bay in Oakland area where we were. So anyway. Huh. That was another story.
Oh, we'll get that one.
Okay. Yeah, I think that was a good experience. But anyway, then off I go to San Diego to the District Public Works office, and she's left behind because she's got to finish out her teaching commitment.
My first job.
Yes.
And she didn't have a driver's license, and I had the car anyway. I'd come back and a local Studebaker dealer, I think I may have mentioned this, cars were coming in, and he reserved every other place for returning veterans. So I got a car pretty soon. So when I had the car, I dated her, and we used that 47 Studebaker Champion, the greatest car. Anyway, so I go on to San Diego, and I'm given some assignments now because I'd specialized in foundations and soil mechanics and had done had a little bit of experience at Okinawa on the Yanaburu Airport. So they signed me to an office under the in the materials section, and basically in cooperation with the people in the, upstairs in the design, I was my job was the design of the pavements and write the specifications for the for this, and eventually to be on call when the construction was on to go out and referee any problem. By this time, I've been promoted, incidentally. I'm now a great big Lieutenant JG. And so I would visit these places when they're under construction and then go back and write more specifications. And we had a quite an 11th Naval District, and we had airfields in Arizona and in Southern California, and some big airfields, El Toro and Miramar, and places like this. And then we actually started a brand new one up around Santa Rosa. Starting, it had just a little sort of a civilian type field, and we were going to build it up to, because they were bringing in a lot of new jets on the line, and they're training pilots to land and operate off of these new airfields. The jets were tougher on them in some respects than the normal propeller airplanes were. So let's see, now now I did that for 2 years, 51 to 53, and then the war's over. And President Eisenhower came by one day, it's re-election, so I waved to him. He drove by on a parade right in front of the, because the Navy was, the San Diego was basically a Navy town at that time. So anyway, then I had some opportunities to stay in the Navy, and we debated that because I liked the service. I really did. I fitted in quite well, and I could have stayed. But we decided to go back to university. I was offered an instructor's or lecturer's appointment at the university, and also to be in charge of the soils and asphalt laboratories and things like that. So went back there, and then we stayed there for 2 years, something like that. And then I was offered a job. I decided, my mentor, Harbor Davis, came to me one day, and he said, Fred, that you're not going to you're up against a glass ceiling without a doctor's degree. You're never going to get promoted much more what you are right now. So I had to decide, and I wasn't really interested in going on for another 4 years. It took me 3 years to get my master's degree because of the research that I had to do. So I decided I have an offer to go with Asphalt Institute, which is a paint materials outfit, mostly on pavements that they did, and so I was interested in that. So I went to work for the Asphalt Institute, and they sent me to Sacramento. We bought our first house in Sacramento, and I was just, as you came, rang the bell almost, and I was laughing about the fact that we were just moving into this house and bought some furniture and what have you. And our daughter had been born in the San Diego Naval Hospital in San Diego in 52. And March 10th, something like that, I think, on Ruth's. And so she's sitting in the living room in this brand new carpet's down there. And I don't know how she had it. I had a little hand drill. And she's sitting there with this little drill with the bits in it, and she's winding the carpet right up out of the...
She was probably 2 years old.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, we could just see, oh, my gosh, what's going to happen. So, and it was right in the middle.
Oh, of course.
Right in the middle of the hair peel. But we found a guy, and we got a patch, and he patched it and made it acceptable. Yeah, it was okay.
A good story, though.
Yeah, we had to put in a fence around, because the first things in California in those days people did, they'd buy their house and build a fence around the backyard. Instead of having, and we found in Illinois, nobody had a fence around the backyard because it was more communal. In California, everybody sort of isolated themselves with this doggone fence. And we shared it with the neighbors. Of course, they paid for half of it, and we I pulled a, pretty much built it myself. And then we had to build a patio out and back. And then I met a guy from the California Highway Department that I got familiar with because he was doing an awful lot of stuff for the Highway Department that I was interested in. And he was teaching me a lot because he had a lot of experience in this sort of stuff. Von Marco is his name, and he's going to be in my life for a long time. But anyway, we would go out in the field with him, and he taught me how an awful lot about production and placement and everything else about that. And okay, let's see. We're in Sacramento now, right? Yeah. Okay. Then I got a offer from my boss in San Francisco. There's an opening on this research project in Illinois, and if you want to go take that assignment, why, we can, you'll get a little promotion out of it, and you're going to have to travel to go to some place in, you know, in Ottawa, Illinois, I had to look it up in a map. Ruth and I got the map out, started looking at this, and they decided, sure, let's go. It sounded interesting. And that was another good move that I made, actually. I was trying to think of any other connections, but we then...
Well, it was President Eisenhower that...
Right.
Interstate.
They called it the Fifth Interstate Defense System because he was convinced he had experienced the Autobahn in Germany, and he saw how efficient that was. So he wanted this interstate system built for for defense purposes too. So anyway, I come to this to here. They were just starting construction. I was the first guy to kind of come in because we had bought a house in Sacramento, and gosh, I've got the logistics a little fouled up here someplace, but anyway, I came out first, and she's still in Sacramento, and then while they were still starting on the construction, there's still a lot of planning going on for this. They're building this, there are six traffic loops designed for different type of vehicles, from pickups all the way to huge illegal trucks, transport trucks, hauling trucks. So they wanted to test the different pavements, different designs. And so they had one and a half of the loops were all of asphalt construction, and the other half was all Portland cement concrete. And the Army had provided the drivers, so they had to bring in a whole company of drivers. Well, but we had to build them first. It took us a couple of years to build these roads. There were something like, in each one of the tangents, there was 300 and some odd test sections, each one of them built different designs, different thicknesses, sometimes different materials. So we had to instrument all of those instruments. It took us about 2 years. And in the process, the guy that was supervising the flexible, I was assigned to the flexible pavements being, I was a loan staff from the Asphalt Institute. They paid my salary and paid taking care of everything, but I was incorporated somewhat into the ASHTO, is called the ASHTO Road Test, American Association of State Highway Officials Road Test. And the alignment is now on I-80. Between Ottawa, Illinois, and not Streeter, the other one. Anyway, just to the west of the city. And so the Illinois provided this alignment, this land for alignment, and which is now part I-80. And so Mr. Binkelman, A.C. Binkelman, who was the Federal Bureau of Highways, Federal Highway Administration, FHWA, and he wasn't used to the pressure. There was a lot of pressure, a lot of new stuff going into it, a lot of computers coming in, and Bink was more of a field man, a little short guy. I'm about 6'1" at that time. I'm shorter now than I was then. But he was about 5'10" or something like that, maybe a little bit less. But he liked to go out in the field. Mm-hmm. The guy on the rigid pavement was a professor at Texas A&M, and he sat in his office with his little Monroe calculator, just calculating stress, strain, and deformation all day long. And Bink would walk over to me and he said, by this time I had picked up a nickname in the service of Mickey Finn. So everybody on the on the road test knew me as Mickey. So he would walk over and say, Mickey, let's go out and see what's going on. He was interested in what's going on in the field. And we'd have men out there doing plate bearing tests and putting in instrumentation in the foundations and getting ready for the construction. And I know that the guys would say, here comes Mutt and Jeff, because our difference in size is so much. But he got ill. He got a nervous breakdown. Had to go to the hospital. So Mr. Walt McKinley, is that not quite Walt? Anyway, he took me aside out on the parking lot one day and he said, Mickey, I can't officially do this with you because you're just lone staff. You're not officially part of my staff. But he says, Bink is in pretty bad trouble, and would you be willing to take over in his place until he can come back? Well, that was a great opportunity for me. So I said, sure, I would be glad to do that. So then I had to take all of the guys that were doing all the instrumentation, and we got together a little in the office one morning, and I told them this is what's going to happen, and made certain assignments. And so these guys were all local people. None of them had a degree. All of them had been through high school, but they were the greatest bunch of guys I've worked with in a long, long time. And they just pitched in and they just took over. They did instrumentation. They planned it. I told them what we needed to have, and they planned this. So one guy was pretty good. Another guy was at the project, turned out to be a real good man in instrumentation. So we got, and the concrete guys are doing the same thing on the other side of it. Mm-hmm. The asphalt pavements were always on the north side, and the concrete were always on the south side. And we always said that the weather was worse on the north side than it was on the south side. So anyway, then they started driving the trucks. These trucks were lighted up.
We're just about...
Okay.
So we will continue this at another time, but we will continue that.
I'm sorry, it goes...
Oh, no, no. I want all of it. So this is just delightful.
Computers were just being used for... You could ask a question and get an answer very fast, and they had a computer, one of the first in the country.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was big. This room.
You'll have to tell me about that on the next one.
Well,
have your career.
They had to build this room for this computer, air conditioned, of course, and we all had to go to Chicago to be trained in the use of the computer, program writing and everything on simple languages at that particular time. And so we had vans out in the field that were electronically equipped to tapes. They would print out